Hello and welcome to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales. If you're joining us for the first time, you're very welcome. And if you're back to see us again, I'm so pleased you found your way back here. This week's episode is going to be an interesting one, at least I hope so. Our story is from Beautiful Angiola, which is a collection of Sicilian stories that were collected by Laura Gonzenbach, which I'll explain a little bit later on. Our stories will be the same sort of normal layout that we usually go for. So first there'll be the story, and then some information about the story, some of the folklore, and also some history about the food, and then there'll be the recipe. So, are you listening comfortably? Then I'll begin. Once upon a time, there was a man whose wife died and left him with two children, a boy named Pepe and a girl named Maria. Both children were very beautiful, and their father loved them with all his heart. He was, however, a poor man, and could only support them by gathering firewood in the forest and selling the wood city. After some time had passed, the man considered marrying again. "Oh no, no, father, don't do it," Maria implored him. "If you bring a stepmother into our home, she will definitely treat us badly." "Don't worry, my child. After all, I'm here, and I'll always protect you and continue to love you as much as I do now." So, I married a neighbour who was a tavern keeper and had a daughter. Everything went well, but soon the stepmother became very unfriendly towards Maria and her brother. Because Maria was so beautiful, the stepmother clearly couldn't stand with her and thought of any way she could to cause her ruin. One day, she said to her husband, "Times are terrible. The bread has become so expensive, your children eat so much that we'll soon become beggars. Get rid of your children, because I'm not going to give them anything else to eat." "But where should I send my children?" the father asked. "Take them deep into the forest tomorrow, to a place where they won't be able to find their way back," the stepmother answered. "Oh no, how can I do such a thing? How can I leave my children in the forest all alone? I love them too much." Well, maybe he didn't love them enough. And just as it's customary for wives always get their way with husbands, this husband too allowed himself to be persuaded by his wife. So he woke his two children very early the next morning and said, "Come, come, come, children. I know a beautiful spot in the forest where we can find lots of wood today." They set out and took some bread with them. And along the way, they met a man who was selling lupini beans. "Father," said Maria, give us a little bit of money just so we can buy some lupini beans." Their father gave them a very small amount, and the children bought the lupini and ate them along the way. As they walked, they threw the shells onto the ground. Finally, they reached a certain spot in the forest, and their father said, "Look, the children, over there there's loads of twigs. Go and make bundles while I chop down this old tree trunk." While the children were gone, the father took a large pumpkin and tied it to the branch of the tree so it would swing and hit the trunk, and then he crept away and went home. The children worked the entire day, and when they stopped every now and again, they heard the pumpkin hitting the trunk and thought it was their father's axe and cheerfully continued gathering wood. When the evening arrived, Maria said, "Father's been working for a long time today. Let's go and call him so we can go home." They went back to the spot where they'd left their father, and they couldn't find him. They began calling him, but he didn't answer. And when they caught sight of the pumpkin, they realised he had left them alone in the dark forest. Pepe began to weep bitter tears. "Don't cry, Pepe," Maria said. "Early this morning we ate the lupini beans, and if we follow the path of the shells we threw on the ground, we'll come to a spot that we know, and from there we can find our way home." So they followed the path of the shells and found their way out of the forest and arrived happily at their house. In the meantime, their father had sat down at the dinner table, and although now they could afford food, he had no desire to eat. He was weeping and lamenting, "Oh, my poor, poor dear children, I've abandoned you. Now the wild animals will eat you. Oh, oh, my children." All at once, the children called to him from outside the door, "Papa, Papa, here we are, open up." And when the father opened the door, he saw his dear children alive and well, standing right before his eyes. He embraced them and told them to sit down at the table. He was so happy they were there again. Her stepmother, however, was bitter and angry that they had returned, and she didn't hide it. She told her husband once more that he had to take them even further into the dense forest. Her husband refused, but she screamed and screamed at him until he had to promise her with a heavy heart to do what she demanded. Early the next morning, he woke the children again and took them into the forest. Maria was scared he would leave them alone again, so she filled her pockets and her brother's pockets with beans, and along the way they ate the beans and spread the shells along the path. Their father led them to a spot in a forest where they had never been before. "Oh, Father, Papa, how strange, unlike normal places it is. It's so eerie," the children said. "That's all the more reason we'll find much more wood here. No one else comes here. So go further into the forest to a spot where there are a lot of twigs, and I'll just start chopping this tree trunk." The children went to the spot their father indicated, but he tied a pumpkin on the branch again and snuck back home. When it became evening, Maria said, "Pepe, I still hear Father chopping down the tree. He must be exhausted. Let's go and find him." When they reached the tree where the pumpkin was hanging, they didn't see him, and they realised that he had once again deserted them. "Don't cry, Pepe," Maria said. "We just need to follow the bean shells, and we'll soon find our way home." So they followed the shells and reached home when it was pitch black. The father was sat at the dinner table, not eating, crying and moaning and lamenting again about his poor children. "Papa, Papa, here we are. Open up," they called from outside the house. And their Papa opened the door. He was full of joy and he hugged them and embraced them, his dear, dear children. But their wicked stepmother was more and more angry that the children had found their way home again, despite everything. She threatened if her husband did not abandon the children alone in the forest again, she would chase them away. So the man woke his children early in the morning and said, "Come, let's go to the forest and look for food." Maria wanted to fill her pockets once more with beans. She was quite suspicious by this time, but there were no more to be found. So she took a handful of bran and stuck it into her pocket. While she walked with her father, she spread a little bran on the path. The father took them to some very dense, dark spot in the forest and then sent them somewhat further into the woods to look for twigs. He repeated his trick with a pumpkin, for which he apparently had no shame, and went home. When it began to get dark, the children set out to look for their father, but they didn't find him, and they found the pumpkin and realised he had once again abandoned them. "Don't cry, Pepe," Maria said. "I spread bran along the way. We only have to follow the trail of the bran and we'll definitely find our way home." However, no matter how much they looked, they didn't find their way, because the wind had blown the bran from the path and the children lost their way and went deeper and deeper into the dark forest. They began to shed bitter tears and sat down beneath the tree to wait for sunrise. When dawn came, they wandered further, but they didn't find their way out of the forest. Oh, Maria, I'm so thirsty," said Pepe. "When we come to a brook, please let's get a drink of water." So, right after, they came to a small stream and Pepe wanted to drink. However, Maria heard stream murmur, "If you drink from my water, you'll become a snake and your brother a little serpent." "Oh, Pepe, Maria, I don't drink. Otherwise, you'll become a little serpent. Let's wait till the next stream." Further on, they came to another one and Pepe said, "Look, Maria, we can get a drink here." But the stream murmured, "Whoever drinks from my water will become a rabbit." "Don't drink, Pepe," said Maria, "otherwise you'll become a rabbit. We'd better wait a little bit." As they walked some distance, they came to another stream. This one murmured to Maria, "If you drink from me, you'll become more beautiful than the sun, and your brother will turn into a sheep with gold horns." "Oh, Pepe, don't..." Oh. You see, Pepe had already bent over to drink, and no sooner had he taken a few sips than he was transformed into the most darling little sheep with pretty gold horns. It had taken this long, but this time Maria couldn't help but weep. Pepe, however, still remained a sheep. Maria continued to wander with a heavy heart, but before she departed, she couldn't see the harm in drinking some of the water herself, and became even more beautiful than she had been, more beautiful than the sun. When they had travelled for some time, they came to a cave and crawled inside. And because there were no wild animals there, Maria said, "We can live here. During the day, I'll go around and look for herbs, and we can live off those." So Maria made a bed in the cave out of dry leaves and searched for herbs and berries and small nuts in the forest to nourish herself and her brother. Many, many years went by in this way, and Maria grew to become the most beautiful of all maidens. Now one day, the king happened to go hunting and came to the area of the cave. All of a sudden, his dogs went mad, barking and running around, and then crawled into the cave. So the king sent one of his hunters to see what they'd found. The hunter crept into the cave and saw the lovely maiden trying to shelter at the back, scared of the dogs. He went back and reported to the king, who shouted, "Come out, whoever you are, we won't harm you." Maria didn't really feel she had a choice, so she came out And when she stood there, she looked more beautiful than the sun and the moon, and the king instantly fell madly in love with her and said, "Beautiful maiden, do you want to come to me to my castle and become my wife?" "Yes," she answered. It had been a long time in those woods. But I have to bring my sheep with me, else I can't come." The king agreed and took the beautiful Maria on his horse and rode with her to his castle, and one of his hunters led the little sheep, that was of course Beppe. When the old queen saw her son appear with this wondrous creature, she cried out in astonishment, "Who is this girl you're bringing out of the forest?" "Mother, this maiden is to become my wife," the king responded. To be sure, the queen was not specially pleased by this, but she loved her son so much, she always let him have his way, and Maria was so beautiful and so kind and so gentle that she soon won the queen's heart. So a splendid wedding was celebrated, and beautiful Maria became queen, and her little sheep still followed her everywhere she went. He even had a little bed in her room. Now that she lived in such glory and splendour, Maria no longer thought about the bad treatment she'd received from her stepmother. On the contrary, her generous nature meant she sent her father and stepmother and her stepmother's daughter presents and let them know that she was now a queen. Her stepmother's heart, however, was still very dark and became filled with envy because her own daughter had not been as lucky, and she thought of ways to bring about the ruin of the young queen. When she later heard that Maria was about to give birth, she set out with her daughter on a day the king had gone off on a hunt. Maria received them in a friendly way, showed them round the whole castle, and finally took them up to her own room. There they saw a locked window. And the tricky stepmother said, "Why is that window closed with a shutter?" It's right above the sea," Maria answered, "and the king doesn't want me to open it in case I might fall out." "Oh, open it, Maria," the stepmother requested. "I'd like to see the sea from here, and I'll hold on to you in case you're afraid of falling out." Now, Maria had always longed to see how the sea would look from her room, so she allowed herself to be persuaded and opened the window. And, as she was leaning out, her stepmother gave her a big push, so she fell straight into the sea. Right beneath the window was a shark, which held open its jaws, and when Maria fell into the water, the shark swallowed her. Then the false stepmother put the queen's nightgown onto her daughter and her nightcap and told her to lie down in the bed, and she left the castle in a big hurry. After the king came home and heard that the young queen was lying in bed, he went up to her. He thought she was unwell. He looked at her and she looked so different and not like his beautiful wife. "What's happened to you?" he said. "You look so different. What's happened?" "I'm sick," she said. "The wicked sheep rammed into me with his horns. He's made me sick. That's why he's got to die." The king was furious and had the sheep locked up in the castle dungeon and ordered the cook with knives. The dungeon lay close to the sea. All at once, the guard heard the sheep begin to moan and speak. "Sister, oh sister, oh curly hair, they're sharpening the knives and taking great care to prepare the kettles to be nice and bright, then they'll cut my throat and create a great sight." All at once the voice answered from the water, "Brother dear, I can't help you, I fear, the wicked shark has me in his jaw, I can't even give birth any more." So the guard went to the king and told him what had happened. The king was astounded and went to the place where the guard usually stood. All at once he heard the little sheep lament, "Sister, oh sister, oh curly hair, they're sharpening the knives and taking great care to prepare the kettles to be nice and bright, then they'll cut my throat and create a great sight." Immediately there was a response from a voice in the sea, "Brother dear, I can't help you, I fear, the wicked shark has me in his jaw, I can't even give birth any more." The king recognised his wife's voice and had the sheep fetched from the dungeon and said, tell me, who were you speaking with?" "With my sister Maria," the sheep said. "She's sitting in the jaw of a shark because her stepmother threw her out of the window. Her daughter's the one lying upstairs in the bed." The king became very happy and said, "Little sheep, go to the sea. Ask your sister how I can rescue her." The little sheep went and spoke his verse, and after Maria answered him, he continued, "Tell me, Maria, how can you be rescued?" "You'll need a strong iron hook with a large piece of bread stuck on it," she answered. "When I answer your verse, it'll be a sign that the shark is sleeping on the surface of the water and his jaw is open. Then the king must stick the hook into the jaw of the shark so that I can hold on to it while he pulls me out." And that's what they did. When Maria answered the sheep, the king stood ready with a large hook. He threw it into the jaw of the shark and pulled towards him with all of his might, while Maria held onto the hook and was pulled out. No sooner was she brought into the castle than it was her time, and she gave birth to the loveliest boy. The king was so happy, as was everyone in the castle. But the king had the stepsister's head cut off for treason. The head was chopped into little pieces and salted in a barrel, which was sent to her mother. The servant who took it to the woman told her, "Your daughter, the queen, has sent you this beautiful tuna." When the woman opened the tuna, the barrel to see the tuna, she looked, she even tasted it. At that moment, the servant of the king said, "That's your daughter." The wicked stepmother couldn't stand the fact that she'd done such a dreadful thing, had a heart attack and died. When Maria was healthy again, the king held a great party and they remained happy and content. But we've been left without a cent. And that is the end of my tale, and I hope it pleased you, for it had no other purpose. So, what did you think of the tale? It shares a lot of fairy tale elements of other tales, some of which we've already explored in the episode, which includes the story of the two little pizzas. The tale type is ATU450, little brother and little sister, but there is definitely a passing similarity in parts to ATU480, the false bride, see trapped in fish in the two little pizzas, and even a smidge of ATU403, the kind and unkind girls. There are definitely lots of similarities to the grim tales of the little brother and little sister and Hansel and Gretel, but also to an earlier Italian, or more strictly speaking, Neapolitan tale, Nalillo and Nanella, from Giambattista Basile's Tale of Tales. We haven't visited Basile for a while, have we? People who have listened to some of my earlier episodes may have noticed my interest in this particular publication. It's not exactly an obsession, but I do have a deep interest, especially when we see so many later tales which reference back to it. For those of you who are unaware, the book was originally published in two parts, in 1634 and 1636, posthumously by the sister of the author. It's a collection of folk and fairy tales told in the Neapolitan dialect by an Italian courtier. The collection of 50 stories is framed by an overarching story in a similar fashion to 1001 Nights or the earlier Decameron by Giovanni Boccaccio from the 14th century, which was written in the Florentine vernacular. Basile's collection was also known as the Pentamerone. If you'd like to know why I'm so fascinated by the Pentamerone and your grasp of Italian, Neapolitan dialect is shaky, I suggest you avoid the 19th century, early 20th century translations, as they have lost a lot of nuance. They also removed a lot of what they considered to be coarse or vulgar language due to their prudishness and to make them suitable for their middle-class English audience. Thankfully, Nancy Canepa has produced a wonderful modern translation, which is available via Penguin Books. Anyway, we weren't talking about Basile's tale, but about Maria and her brother, which is a Sicilian tale collected by Laura Gonzenbach in Salinische Märchen, published in 1870. It's not a very Sicilian-sounding name, is it? Well, that's because she wasn't Sicilian. She was Swiss-German, and she translated the oral tales into High German, suitable for her German audience at that time. You might think that invalidates the tales, but actually Laura lived in Sicily for many years and spoke Sicilian dialects fluently, amongst other languages. Her father was a merchant and consul in Messina, and after the death of his wife, he was happy for his eldest daughter, Magdalena, to run his household and the cultural salons of artists and musicians that her mother had done before her. Magdalena essentially raised Laura and her progressive, well, for the time, beliefs about women's education and place in society definitely helped form some of Laura's opinions. Laura collected the tales on behalf of a German pastor, Otto Hartwig, who had originally thought to add them to his historical survey of Sicily, based on his time on the island. He realised they were worthy of a standing alone and worked with Reinhold Köhler, a folklorist, who produced comparing notes for the collection. Unfortunately, Laura was not taken as seriously as she might have been, due to being untrained as a folklorist and a woman, and as well being a foreigner. We also don't have any notes or information about the original tales and how she collected them. We don't know if those existed, but even if they did, all her effects from this time were destroyed in the Messina earthquake of 1909. She told Hartwig that she had not embellished the tales, but something is always lost in translation, and we don't know how much the stories were then changed in the editing process, although Hartwig maintained that very little changed. This uncertainty meant it was easy to dismiss the collection. However, Jack Zipes has translated these stories into English in two volumes and insists that from the language and the way the stories are written, the original oral tales shine through and are as important as Giuseppe Pitre's collection that I discussed briefly in the 13 Bandits episode. Where Laura's collection is different is that the majority of tales she collected were told to her by women, both from countrywomen and lower middle class town dwellers. Her tales, although not feminist in nature, do not shy away from many of the difficulties that women in Sicily suffered in a very poor and patriarchal society. The tales are told from a very female perspective, and only two of the tales in the collection were told to her by men. This female perspective is obvious when we examine similar tales to Maria and her brother. Just the name makes it stand out, Maria and her brother. He is named in the story itself, but not mentioned in the title. In both other variants where the children are named, it's the brother's name that comes first, Ninilo and Ninilla, and Hansel and Gretel. Even in the tale which comes closest to ours, and that entitles the tale type, is little brother then little sister. She is also the leader throughout the story, trying desperately to keep her brother from harm, and then protecting him after the inevitable happens. She even manages to save him when she's heavily pregnant inside a shark. The other tales have also a certain amount of weeping and wailing from their female protagonist, and it's always the brother who does the rescuing or moves the story along by his actions, which is not the case in this tale. There are two themes that exist across all the variants, including ours, and that is of the wicked stepmother and the children being abandoned or forced to leave home due to lack of food. I must admit that in the original Grimm collection, which include Hansel and Gretel, it was their mother and not a stepmother, and this was changed in later versions to make it more acceptable to the morals of a Victorian audience which valued family. In the Basile tale, as well as the Grimm little brother and little sister, it always was a stepmother. There are strong themes of jealousy between stepmother, stepdaughter and siblings through a lot of Sicilian tales, and this is a large part of the story. You would think, wouldn't you, that she could leave those poor children alone once she'd forced them out of the house. But no, the enmity seems to be lifelong. The themes of famine and poverty and having more children than you could feed are constants across Europe at this time, but Sicily was particularly affected as a subsistence economy with very high levels of poverty. It's always easy to judge the fathers in these stories, who seem helpless in the face of their wives' fury, but actually being killed by cold or wild creatures might possibly have been a slightly better and definitely quicker death than a slow death of by starvation, which was always very possible. We don't know how common child abandonment was through the Middle Ages and later, but it definitely happened, and children were abandoned in forests as well as in special places outside churches set aside just for this purpose. I suppose this brings us quite nicely, in a horror sort of way, to the beans in our story that enabled the children to escape abandonment twice until there were no more left to help them. Lupini beans are an interesting choice here, because they're not really human food even then. They were, and in fact still are, poisonous due to the alkaloids present throughout the bean. These alkaloids can affect the central nervous system, causing depression, convulsions, or even respiratory failure. They're also unpalatable unless they are boiled and then washed, not merely soaked, for about a week or so with frequent changes of water. They never soften with cooking, so are best treated as olives and eaten as a crunchy snack after having been soaked in brine or pickled. You can actually still buy them pickled in jars in Italy, presumably having been treated in this fashion first. The outer skins are still very hard and are often discarded, just as the children did in this story. They actually have more protein than some meat dishes, including burgers, so should be a worthwhile food once you've got rid of those troublesome alkaloids. But strangely, maybe not so strangely, they remain underused except for cattle feed, which is perhaps why they're used in this story, to show just how poor the family was to be eating beans that most people fed to cattle. It was shorthand for the time that we probably don't appreciate as much now. Although beans, particularly dried beans, have long been the foods of the poor. They're an excellent non-meat protein source, but strangely, once people have access to meat, they stop eating them. Eating dried beans has long clearly been declared the eater's lack of status in Western society. It's very strange though. Beans are an essential in agriculture. The ability of their roots to fix nitrogen in the soil and then the grown plants be fed to animals who produce manure, which also enriches the soil, is a key component of agriculture. Everyone focuses on grains, but the soil in which grain grows has to be rested and or enriched if all the nutrients in the soil aren't to be used up. Beans can then be planted in the fallow rest year to enrich the soil, feed animals and also store and dry some of the crop which can be eaten in times of famine. They're very portable in their dried form and excellent for travel or migrating, which is how they spread from their origin in the Fertile Crescent across Europe and later back and forwards across the Atlantic. So why weren't they more popular? Why aren't the early cookbooks overflowing with recipes for them? There are some clues with the Greeks and Romans. Pythagoras was very anti them, amongst other Greek philosophers, and believed the beans contained the souls of those who had died, as well as those who had not been born. He thought the gas that was released during the digestion of dry beans was actually people's souls being released from the beans. He also had an unpleasant experience in a bean field and directed his followers to avoid them at all costs. The Roman elite did not eat them. Well, they did eat them, but only when mixed with interesting exotic ingredients to avoid damaging their status. However lowly they were, considered as a foodstuff in a strange way, they were valued as part of Rome's proud farming heritage, and several elite families bore names based on fava beans and chickpeas. Lentils definitely weren't valued and were used as packing in one famous case of a monument. Beans were planted across Roman estates, though they were food of the poor even amongst the Romans. However, during the Dark Ages across Europe after the Romans, it wasn't possible to plan long-term agricultural projects. In the early Middle Ages, the status of beans was slightly elevated, however, by Christianity. The need to observe fast days and periods such as Lent meant that everyone who couldn't afford dispensations or struggled to catch beavers or import dolphins was reliant on alternative sources of food. In Lent, particularly, this meant beans, as in early spring, only some fresh crops were beginning to appear and winter stores had been used up, including any precious preserved meat. Beans had the advantage they could be grown the year before and dried and kept for spring without spoiling. This did not help the beans' reputation as a poverty or austerity food. It was only during periods where meat was affordable for the majority that eating beans didn't necessarily mean you were lower class. This was true after the Black Death swept Europe and millions died. It was a terrible time, but for those that survived, there was a short period of almost democratic prosperity where most people could afford to eat meat and bean recipes flourished. There were some other reasons, but it's an interesting observation. It's also noticeable across the Western world and that most people can eat meat. Interesting in vegetarianism and veganism or plant-based lifestyles have partly resulted in the popularity of perennial ingredients such as beans, and high-priced specialist crops have become a sign of status. It must be noted that this is more noticeable in Northern Europe. In Southern Europe, beans have remained much more popular. It's worth noting here as well, perhaps, that chickpeas are actually beans too. Anyway, I've skipped several centuries, but just to fill in, dried beans didn't get any more popular during the intervening period. They rarely appear in cookbooks in their dried form until Alexis Soyer and Francatelli started writing cookbooks for the working classes during the Victorian period in England. They did appear as fresh ingredients, but these were considered a luxury and suitable for the moneyed middle classes, so worthy of inclusion. Aside from the soybean, of which we don't have enough time and I don't have enough knowledge to discuss here, the number of bean crops has been declining, and who knows whether the already mentioned changes in eating habits due to ethical and climate concerns will reverse this. In Europe, I perhaps should specify that. Food scientists may well find other uses for beans we haven't thought of yet. Lupini beans apparently show great potential for some industrial uses. Broad beans are still popular for eating there in Sicily, although older people are moving away from dried beans due to their poverty associations. I'm a big fan of dried bean soups, though, due to the writing of Patience Gray and Nigel Slater, and coming from a different country and generation, they don't have the same associations for me. So I was pleased to find that according to Giorgio Locatelli, they are proving more popular with younger generations of Sicilians who want to value their traditional foods. I feel this means it would be a nice idea to use a personal favourite bean recipe here from Giorgio's Food in Sicily, adapted slightly to use more store-cupboard freezer ingredients and also a slightly different method. The recipe, as always, is linked from my show notes and it's also on my website, www.hestiaskitchen.co.uk. All the other information and some further reading will, as always, be available on the show notes and again in further reading on the website. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. It's been so lovely to have you with me and hope you can join me next time. Thank you for listening to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.